Joseph P. Farrell is a regular guest on Coast to Coast, and I always enjoy talking with him. He's a Sodak boy. Joseph, how are you tonight?
Pretty good, Ian. Thanks for having me back on.
Oh, you know what? I can't get enough of you, and I can't get enough of this book. You know, it's so interesting to me. Now, we've talked before about the alternative theories about World War II history, about your research into Nazi technologies in the past.
And it
seems like your work has been building up to this book, Roswell and the Reich. This is kind of where it all seems to come together.
Yeah, and I was kind of driving toward this book way back with SS Brotherhood of the Bell. But you're right, Ian. This is the book I've been driving to, because this book really kind of brings it up to date. It brings it up to the contemporary period. And you know, I'm planning on some special projects with Mr. Hoagland to kind of follow up on this one. So, yeah, this book ties it all together.
Okay. Now, you are still a professor, or you were an adjunct professor? Help me out with a little bit more of your background for people that don't know you.
Yeah, I was an adjunct professor for many years, from about 1991, I'd say, up until about 1998-99. I did have an administrative post for 1 year as well, a full-time post with the University of Oklahoma, doing interdisciplinary seminars and studies that were kind of the team-taught affairs. But yes, I've been in the academic arena.
Right, including work in Oxford?
Oh, yes, that's where, a friend of mine and I call that the old fiend, and that's where I did my PhD work, yes.
At Oxford?
At Oxford, yes, sir.
Not Oxnard, at
no.
Oxford.
No, not Oxnard. No.
Okay, I just want to make that clear, because I don't think people give you enough credit for that's a great pedigree, and no wonder you put so much effort into the research. Everything about what you write is heavily footnoted. In the end, I love the sort of peer reviewable attitude that you bring to your work. You're open to discussion on this,
sure.
But you cross all your T's and you dot all your I's, and that says a lot to me about this. You're not just talking off the top of your head. You dig deep on this stuff.
Well, I try, Ian, and you're right. I do reference things rather heavily, because I realize when you're dealing with material of this nature, especially Roswell, I mean, come on, we have zillions of books out there, so you can't really talk about Roswell unless you research what other people have dug up and what they've put about. And so, yeah, I try and reference things rather heavily, because I do argue in all of my books speculative cases, but the point that I try to make with them is that they are argued cases. I'm not just inventing this, you know. I'm arguing that if you look at facts a certain way, then yes, you can come to these conclusions. So, yeah, I do reference things rather heavily.
Now, have you ever heard back from, you know, anybody at Oxford? Do they ever send you like an email and say, Joseph, Roswell, really?
No, I haven't heard anything from anybody that I knew at Oxford, but
okay.
I do have some contacts that are quite familiar with the place. So.
I bet. Well, you know, I want to unpack your book a little bit different.
Sure.
for the radio tonight. So thank you for going with me on this, because you stack it a little bit differently, but you also make some different assumptions of the reader that I can't make of the listener. So let's back up a little bit and say, explain for the purposes of people who know nothing at all about kind of this sort of crypto technology,
right,
of the Third Reich,
right,
what it is that you and many others believe the Nazis were working on, let's say, in the latter half of World War II.
Well, to be giving you the Cliff Notes version, I think what they were working on, Ian, was a technology that was a gateway technology. My research has been focused on a project called the Nazi Bell. And this project was essentially a gateway technology that I believe they were designing to lead them to three things simultaneously. The first was that they were working on this technology to allow them access to free energy, or so-called zero-point energy. And the reason for this was they essentially wanted to free Germany from dependence on petroleum resources, which, of course, Germany did not have – any of. And during the war, of course, they had to make synthetic oil and synthetic gasoline just to keep their war machine running. The second purpose that they were researching this technology for, and this, of course, is the relevance to Roswell, is that they were researching this for a true field propulsion type of technology that would be, decades in advance of anything that anybody really was working on at the time. The third thing that they were doing, Ian, was they were attempting to weaponize this technology. And let me explain the physics basis of what this technology was. It essentially was a technology that was designed to tap into the fabric of space-time itself. So in other words, if you can engineer the fabric of space-time locally, then you do have a technology that will give you access to these three things, a free energy and a field propulsion device, but as a weapon. Of course, anytime you weaponize this stuff potentially, you have a weapon that would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker. So they were doing truly, truly exotic avant-garde research.
The as you said, it's sort of a three-pronged thing. They get one, they get all three in a way.
Right.
That if they can, and the belief is that there's some physical evidence that they had even constructed what might be, by some people's estimation, a kind of launching pad for some type of new craft. Talk about that.
Well, there is the place where all of this technology was tested is a little town in Germany. At the time, it was known as Ludwigsdorf, but now, of course, it's part of Poland, and the Polish name is Ludwikowice. But there is a structure there that looks rather like Stonehenge. It looks like a very modern version of a hinge. It's made out of concrete. It's about, 40 to 45 feet wide, about 30 feet tall. It sits in kind of a basin or a pool. There are some people that have argued, I think quite erroneously, that this was a cooling tower for an electrical power plant. But the problem, Ian, and I want to bring this point to those people arguing this way, that there does exist an Allied photo reconnaissance photo from the end of the war where there is absolutely no cooling tower present and never was. So this structure was used to test this Bell device. And the important point here, Ian, is to note that this device was apparently seen by some of the concentration camp victims in the nearby camp of Gross Rosen during the night, rising above the tree line, glowing a kind of a pale blue glow, which to me signifies the use of plasma and very high voltage electricity in this device. But then this device would settle back down below the tree line, and apparently this hinge was probably the structure that was used to test the device outdoors. So, yes, this is quite a story. And I want to add one more thing to kind of make it relevant to today. At the end of the war, as the Nazis are kind of driving the technological division of the spoils, what they did, Ian, was they, in my opinion, created more or less a stalemate in the division of the spoils between the United States and the Soviet bloc. But this project, according to my research, I believe went to Argentina and remained in independent Nazi hands after the war. And that's the key link here to Roswell.
Okay. We'll get back to that. Because I think that what you're getting at is what a lot of people would have assumed,
right?
Since there was, Operation Paperclip afoot to get as many of the Nazi rocket scientists into U.S. control to keep them out of the hands of the Soviets. By and large, the Nazi rocket club there wanted to go to the United States. They didn't want to go to the Soviet Union.
Right.
They saw that they had a marketable skill that they, in many cases, felt they weren't real Nazis anyway. They were scientists who merely were forced to toil under the jackboot of Hitler, and therefore it was easier for them to make a new life for themselves and their family in the United States than kind of the reparations that they would have to make in the Soviet Union, where they would be forced almost at sort of like a gunpoint to be rocket scientists for the Soviet Union or to be able to live free in the U.S.
Right.
So but so the thought has always been that it was sort of like two for us, one for you, you know, one for us, one for you, as we're kind of dividing this up toward the end. But you make the argument that some, at least some of them, escaped to Argentina. Who, at the end of the war, who is unaccounted for?
Well, there's a whole lot of people, and two figures in particular are going to be very crucial in our discussion tonight. One of them is a scientist by the name of Dr. Ronald Richter, who is, in my opinion, the scientist that continued this Bell project in Argentina, more or less under the ostensible oversight, you might say, of Juan Perón and his government. But it's very obvious to me that Perón is really not the one in charge of this project. There's somebody else. The other character that we need to pay very close attention to down in Argentina is Reimar Horton, who was, of course, the designer of the Horton brothers' team of the famous German flying wing designs. He made it to Argentina after the war, and in fact, he was involved in the design and building of very, very advanced aircraft for Juan Perón in Argentina. I even have a picture of one of these things in the book. It's a Delta Wing jet aircraft, very
right.
Advanced looking.
Years before we had them in the at the level that the Nazis were developing. They had the edge on this. And then at the same time too, you see those Delta Wings, and that brings us back to what a lot of people say they saw over Phoenix in the famous Phoenix light.
Yes,
I mean, that was a Delta Wing kind of craft that was moving very slowly.
Yes, exactly. He's one of the key figures here, Ian, because he's mentioned in one of the crucial documents that forms a central component of the arguments of, I'll call them the extraterrestrial proponents within Roswell research. He is mentioned in one of the documents that they themselves cite as evidence for the extraterrestrial nature of Roswell. But, as I point out in Roswell and the Reich, the version of the document that they're citing is a fake version. The original version does not mention extraterrestrials at all. The only concern in that original version of this document is that this technology the U.S. Air Force has concluded is something that comes ultimately from the Third Reich. And when you say that, the mask is off, because this means that the Air Force is really concerned that there is some continuation of Nazism out there, if you read the document carefully enough. And if that's the case, then where's this technology coming from? And where is Reimar Horton? You know, the document even mentions him by name in that exact context.
Yeah, and that's a great teaser for where we're going to end up, because why would any of these names come up after the crash of Roswell? We're talking years after the end of World War II. So why even talk about that? How could that even be relevant? So World War II comes to an end. Everybody for themselves. Some people grab, you know, a sub or a ship and get to Argentina. Other people are willingly walking up with their hands up in the air saying, please take me, you know, to the U.S. And others are being taken away to the Soviet Union. And we think it's over. We've got as many of the rocket scientists as we could possibly find. We begin the rehabilitation program to try to turn them into Americans and to get the technology they've been working on. But going back to that piece, nobody is talking about that, the possibility that they had come up with this alternative form of energy. We're not hearing it doesn't appear in the historical record.
Right.
We're left to try to put that together in the rearview mirror of history. So what we do know is that there was something going on toward the end of World War II that it had something to do with an alternative energy source that they were also hoping to weaponize and to give them the Hail Mary pass, if you pardon the term, for them to try to win the war.
Right.
And that's just where we're leaving. Now, hang on, Joseph, then we'll talk. Then let's skip ahead and let's talk about the events of Roswell.
Sure.
Prior to all of the other modern research, let's strip away all of the other research that's come. Let's go back to that day And then the series of reports that came up immediately following the original Roswell incident, okay? And then we'll start putting it all back together again. Joseph P. Farrell is the author of Roswell in the Reich. Does this sound crazy to think that there's a Nazi connection in the crash at Roswell? Joseph P. Farrell has a PhD from Oxford. What do we know? Nothing. Not till we find out next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Joseph P. Farrell, author of Roswell and the Reich. I was teasing my friend Harry Shearer last night about his Wikipedia page. And you have a lot of cool stuff on your page. But do you know that you're not listed as notable alumni from your from John Brown University? Well, and you should be. That's where you went to undergrad, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. That's correct.
Well, you should be. That is an oversight. You know, I've never heard of any of the other people that they put up there as notable alumni. You should be on the list. I remember John Brown University made the news a couple of years. That's in Arkansas, right?
That's right. Asylum Springs, Arkansas.
I remember when it made news a couple of years ago when they were trying to update their image. It's a conservative liberal arts college. By having a swing dance.
Well, that's about right.
They were letting their hair down a little bit. They're having a swing dance. I love that. God bless them for that. All right, so let's get back to let's talk about Roswell itself. The real story of Roswell, and I say the real story meaning the original story of Roswell. There's lots of different ways that the Roswell story can be told.
Right.
But let's just go back to what. Kind of like the baseline of which there is little dispute. And this is based on the original newspaper accounts
right.
and the original testimony.
Right. Well, the original story, Ian, to me, is where the story gets fascinating right off the bat. Because the story is that a rancher, his name is Mac Brizzle, found a bunch of debris, very peculiar debris, on his ranch, sheep ranch, about 75 miles northwest of Roswell. He boxed up a bunch of this debris, took it into town, and showed it to the sheriff, who really wasn't that interested, but said he should contact the local airbase. At that time, Roswell was home to the 509th Bomb Group, which, of course, was the only atomic bomb group in the world at the time. So the base commander, a fellow by the name of Colonel William Blanchard, his nickname was Butch, he sent his base intelligence officer, Major Jesse Marcel Sr., out to this ranch along with the base's counterintelligence officer, Sheridan Cavett, to look at this debris on this ranch. And Marcel, of course, is now kind of the central character in the Roswell story because he later, much later in life, was contacted by the researchers Stanton Friedman and Bill Moore who interviewed him, and he described this very strange debris as being kind of a light foil-like material that you could crumple up and it would unbend. You could blow through this stuff. It had very strange kind of hieroglyphic-looking characters on it. It had numbers and so on and so forth. Well, that's the beginning of the Roswell story because the local airbase there put out a press release by Lieutenant Walter Hout, who was the base press officer, and the Roswell Daily Record ran this story based on this press release. And the story was that the U.S. Air Force had recovered a flying saucer. And end of story.
Right.
That was the original story. And mere hours later, of course, Major Marcel, the intelligence officer, was ordered to report to the headquarters of the 8th Army, U.S. Army Air Force in Fort Worth, Texas. So he flies to Fort Worth, Texas with this debris. And then, of course, there, the U.S. Air Force changes the story, Ian, within mere hours after releasing the flying saucer press release. And this time they come out and say, oh, it was just a case of mistaken identity of a flying saucer. What we really recovered was just a weather balloon. Now, to me, Ian, this sets up what I call the Roswell dialectic because every version of the Roswell story that researchers have told since then, be they ET proponent or skeptic, has been locked into an explanation or a defense either of we recovered a crashed extraterrestrial craft, or it was just a balloon of some sort.
Right. Right.
There's no in between with this story. And that is what really has fascinated with me all along, because we're being asked to believe in the case of the balloon story, that the senior intelligence officer of the only atomic bomb group in the world at the time can't tell the difference between a weather balloon and a flying saucer, you know.
Right, because one of the qualifications of becoming the head of that program was to be an idiot. And so they
yes, of course, yeah.
Right. But let's talk about the beings. The
sure.
Story that what was the original testimony mm-hmm. about any human-like beings that were found at the crash site?
Okay, well, that's problem number one, Ian, because in the original first layer of the story, there isn't any testimony about the recovery of bodies. There's no mention of bodies whatsoever. This is a point that emerges much later. In fact, it begins to come out when the Roswell story begins to be researched by Charles Berlitz and Bill Moore, and then, of course, Stanton Friedman and Don Berliner.
Right.
This is where we have the bodies. And I'm not saying that they're added to the story, but they simply emerge at a much later point in the story, okay? Now, the interesting thing, Ian, is, and I try to do this very, very carefully in the book, the interesting thing to me is that the witnesses who have maintained that they saw bodies are, by and large, number one, for the most part, they are witnesses who testify secondhand based on somebody's explanations or stories that were told to them before they died. Okay?
If, for example, my dad told me later on what he wouldn't tell the press, that there was, you know, there were bodies there.
Exactly.
That my dad said this later on, and right. Or I found
exactly.
this in his writings or whatever. Right.
Exactly. Now, this is problem number one with the story, because, of course, in any court of law, at least in American jurisprudence, that sort of testimony would not be admitted. So this is the first problem. But the second problem to me is even more interesting. Let's assume for the sake of argument that these witnesses who describe bodies did in fact see bodies, or they relayed their stories accurately and faithfully to those who eventually reported them. The problem here, Ian, as I see it, is the bodies that are being described are almost uniformly said to be between about 4 to 5 feet tall. They have disproportionately large heads, and so on and so forth. And the problem is that in most cases, in all but two cases, in fact, we are treated to a description of bodies that do not compel to any extraterrestrial origin for them. The only two exceptions are the case of Sergeant Melvin Brown, who described bodies with kind of an orange-yellow, beady, lizard-like skin. But the person that tells his story, namely his daughter, has changed her story so many times that it throws the whole testimony into suspicion. The other person that described bodies of a very peculiar nature was, of course, the famous mortician Glenn Dennis, who referred to the testimony of a nurse friend of his that described these bodies to him. Unfortunately, he managed to impeach himself as a witness, so his testimony is no longer reliable.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, in his case, he maintained that his nurse friend, he did not recall her name, and then he changed the name to Roswell researchers. In other words, what he did, in effect, was he lied to the very researchers that were trying to uncover this story. So his testimony is no longer admitted, even by many of the mainstream Roswell researchers. He's an impeached witness. So what the thing that we're left with, Ian, at this point then, is if you leave out these two witnesses that describe such unusual physiological features, and they're both inconsistent with each other, and they're both inconsistent with the other witnesses who describe bodies. So what we're left with is that main group of witnesses who are describing simply small bodies. In their words, they often say they look like children about 10 to 12 years old.
Right.
They have very large eyes, you know, other strange features. But there is in that list of features nothing that compels to the fact that these were extraterrestrial beings. We simply have very odd-looking humans. That's what we're dealing with.
By the way, I, too, once had a very good nurse friend. And I'm not saying how good a friend. I'm just saying I would have been kicked out of John Brown University. So I'm willing to attest to. It would impeach any testimony I give. But this is the part I think that was really interesting that I'd never heard before until I read the book. Again, we're talking with Dr. Joseph Farrell and the Roswell Reich book, The Nazi Connection, between these two very seemingly disconnected events in history, the end of World War II and the recovery of Nazi technology and the crash of something in Roswell in 1947, a couple of years later, that that when they found, according to some people, and you'll remember this better than I will, but I remember in your book that they were attempting to speak in German,
yes,
or Japanese or Spanish to these beings,
yes,
on the ground. What's with talking in German or Spanish?
Well, again, you know, this particular story is to me the whole problem with Roswell, as the standard pro extraterrestrial interpretation of it would have us believe, because first of all, the witness saying these things, you know, maintaining that they were trying to communicate with these beings that they discovered outside, you know, kind of littering the ground outside this crashed craft. Well, this witness is one of those witnesses whose testimony has now been rejected by the very Roswell researchers who dug him up in the first place, okay?
Right.
So if we assume then, just for the sake of argument, that the testimony is to be admitted, let's go back to circa 1993, 1994 in the evolution of the Roswell mythology, okay?
Okay.
When that witness was first produced, it didn't occur to the researchers to ask why in the name of sense are they trying to talk to these supposedly extraterrestrial creatures in Spanish, Japanese, and German.
Right.
Exactly. So in other words, all the clues, even by some of the impeached witnesses, point again in a completely terrestrial direction. And this is the problem with the story as far as I'm concerned, because we're clearly dealing with something that the military wants covered up, obviously, because the balloon story, pardon my pun here, just isn't going to float.
Right.
But the problem with the extraterrestrial story is, number one, we at the first layer of the story, we don't have any mention of bodies whatsoever. What we really have is a story about some very unusual debris. So if we rationalize the bodies as being terrestrial, then the real problem with Roswell is the debris and where does it come from. And if we, again, go back to that document that I mentioned in the first half hour of the show, the document itself, cited by those Roswell researchers, makes it very clear that the concern of U.S. Air Force intelligence is that this ultimately comes from the Third Reich.
So, again, I'm going to make you hang that out for just a few more minutes before
sure.
we get back to it, because I want to amplify that the on the first level of research, we have no mention at all of bodies.
Right.
In the second level, there are mentions of bodies
sure.
at the Roswell crash, but they appear to be terrestrial bodies because the people who are there are trying to speak to them in terrestrial languages,
right,
and the languages of our former enemies during World War II.
Yes.
So, which is really interesting. That
yeah, it is.
Again, if these were to use the explanation later on by the Air Force that what were perceived as extraterrestrials, which they're willing to cop to, were really just test dummies
yes.
that went up with this weather balloon. If that were true, then you'd have soldiers that were no smarter than than being than somebody who couldn't tell the difference between a living human being and a test dummy, and they're trying to talk German to a dead dummy.
Or an extraterrestrial. Exactly.
Or an extraterrestrial. I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Of course not. Of course not. But and that's the whole problem here, Ann. You've put your finger right on it.
So when we peel it back, just let's dial it back a little bit to what we know, that in 1947 something landed, and that there were everybody from the very beginning stipulated that there were symbols on some of the – there was language markings on some of this debris. Now, talk about why they thought that it might be Japanese.
Well, that's very easy, because one of the things that Major Marcel says in his first interviews is that the characters that he saw looked rather like Chinese or Japanese writing. And that was a description that was repeated by the son of the rancher that actually discovered the debris. His name was Bill Brazel, okay? And Bill said the same thing, that some of this writing that his father described to him looked rather like Chinese or Japanese characters with a lot of, and here's another clue for you, Ian, with a lot of numbers, okay? So my second problem with the descriptions of the debris is that the witnesses describing it mentioned these numbers. Well, how do you recognize numbers? They've either got to be Arabic numerals or they've got to be Roman numerals.
Right.
You know, E.T. is probably not going to be using the same system, symbolic system of numerology.
Exactly.
So,
but it wouldn't be uncommon for somebody who was Asian, say an Asian scientist, to use Western style numbers.
Exactly. So again, we have another clue that from the debris itself that bespeaks of a terrestrial origin for it. And what I believe has happened, Ian, is that to a certain extent, I'm willing to entertain the idea that the extraterrestrial component was added to the story or spun into the story by the Air Force at the outset with that initial flying saucer recovery story, precisely in order to prevent people from looking too closely and in too much detail at the descriptions of the debris.
Okay, but I don't think, I mean, I remember reading that part. I don't even think, if I could be critical, I don't even think you need to do that.
I would agree.
Yeah, I think what you have here are people who are processing in real time, whose real thoughts are coming out along a natural human timeline where they're associating the unfamiliar with some known fact that already exists in their mind. I mean, they're trying to make sense of the nonsensical. So if you've got some craft that has crashed, you're looking for these touchstones into things that you already can understand, so that we kind of bring, if you'll pardon it, they're attempting to bring intellectual order to intellectual chaos.
Exactly. I couldn't agree with you more. That's precisely the point.
So they don't even have to be thinking of a cover story. They're just saying, well, and in a way, it was extraterrestrial, at least in the sense that they knew it wasn't from us. They knew it wasn't from the United States.
Exactly.
And that's all that they knew. But they did, and this is what we also have as part of the record, they did think that it could have come from the Third Reich.
Right. That's right.
Now, why would they think that this craft could have come from a government that had been vanquished 2 years prior? That's where we'll pick it up, coming up at the top of the hour. And that will bring us back to missing documents, missing scientists, missing technology that all ended up in Argentina. It may also explain why somebody was trying to speak Spanish to these dead beings on the ground. And this is how we'll start to make the Roswell-Reich connection, the Nazi connection that's in Joseph P. Farrell's latest book. You can link up to him through our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Punnett. We know from Operation Paperclip that the U.S. knew that there were new breakthroughs in rocket technology that we didn't yet have, that the Nazis had been working on successfully, that we wanted. We wanted to have it in our hands before it got into the hands of the Soviet Union. Originally, those breakthroughs were being thought of as being the must-have weapons, but also in the back of our minds we're thinking that there are some energy technologies as well. We may not have known everything, and that's where we bring back in Joseph P. Farrell. The new book is about Roswell and the Reich. So how many Nazi scientists do we know made it to Argentina and ended up in neither the U.S. or the USSR's labs?
Well, that's really an excellent question, Ian. And the real answer is we know of at least three by name. At least that's what I've been able to uncover in my own research. However, I do know from the nature of the projects that were going on in Argentina that they would have required many, many more people, more scientists, more technicians, and really that number is still very obscure. I would place it at least at around 50, if not much more than that.
Where did they go?
Well, in the case of Dr. Richter and his post-war continuation of the Bell Project, that's another interesting part of the story that has perhaps some contemporary relevance, because he conducted this project at a town about 900 miles southwest of Buenos Aires called San Carlos de Bariloche. It's in Rio Negro province, which is right across the Andes Mountains from another post-war, infamous post-war Nazi compound in Chile called Colonia Dignidad, which was in that very area of Chile where we had the recent earthquake. So this area of Latin America down towards the tip of the continent there is an area that was heavily, heavily infested with these Nazis. And in the case of Argentina, Perón had actually built most of Richter's laboratories right there in San Carlos. So we have a very sizable establishment that we're dealing with down there, and this is the most disturbing thing about this aspect of the story.
Why would Juan Perón, I mean, what was his interest in funding the further research in these Nazi technologies?
Well, I think that's another excellent question, and putting yourself in Perón's shoes for a moment, I think very obviously, if he had access to these types of advanced energy technologies, these types of advanced aerodyne technologies, and so on and so forth, he could basically cut himself loose from the big brother of the United States, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere. And that very much would have appealed to him, someone like him, being an ardent nationalist. But the other thing that we have to remember about Perón was that he was very, very much a Nazi file. He thought that the Third Reich was just the greatest thing since sliced bread.
Right, right.
So, you know, he had kind of a personal character flaw that I think also made that the logical place for those projects.
Sure. But Argentina has, don't they, ample amounts of petroleum? Haven't they always had their own? Why would they need to bring in alternative forms of energy and spend a lot of money to do it?
Well, I think again, that's very easy, because he is really, by getting his hands on it, he would have access to a technology then that would put him quite literally in the driver's seat as far as the United States is concerned. He would have access to a potential military muscle that he hadn't had before. So, you know, I think in Perón's thinking, this had to have been at least part of the rationale for his public sponsorship of this project going on down there.
As the kids would say today, he wanted to be a playa.
He wanted to be a playa.
Yeah. We know that there's sort of a compound. We know that much like what we were doing, they were both housing and guarding over their treasure, their intellectual treasure.
Right.
And why do we think that they continued the Nazi Bell project there? Are there any photographs of it, or is there any eyewitness testimony that the Nazi Bell project continued?
No, there's not, but there are a number of very peculiar detailed data points that connect the Argentine project to the Nazi Bell project. The first is Richter himself is one of the scientists that very clearly, as I indicate in Roswell and the Reich, was connected to the Bell Project simply because of the nature of the plasma research he was doing for the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft, which was the German company that built the actual Bell device itself. And that's the company that provided Richter all of his equipment in Argentina. But the real crucial thing, as I point out in the previous book in that series, Nazi International, is that if you look at Richter's paperclip file, if you look at the U.S. Air Force studies of Richter, Richter comes right out and says to the U.S. Air Force in the middle 50s, when they finally get around to interviewing the guy, he comes right out and says that what he was really doing for Perón was trying to access the zero-point energy by means of rotating plasma under electrical stress. And if you look at how I have rationalized the Bell device, that is exactly what the Bell device was. So on all these data points, what Richter was doing for Perón connect directly to the Bell. And the other thing I want to mention that ties him into Roswell very, very directly is that when he was doing this research in Nazi Germany, the case is very strong that he knew one of the scientists that made it to this country and that was stationed in Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, and that scientist is none other than Dr. Kurt Davis, who was also involved with a plasma rotation electrical stress project for that very same German company. And it's interesting to me, Ian, that and this is something I don't believe, I'm not certain of this, but I don't believe that any of the other Roswell researchers have picked up on. And that is that after the Roswell incident, the American Army counterintelligence reopened all of the security classification files and cases of these paperclip Nazis, and right at the top of the list of the reopening of these counterintelligence security vetting is none other than Dr. Kurt Davis.
Okay. So I'm going to pull back a little bit, and I sure. think that's very interesting. But when we go back to what the Nazi Bell experiments were, or at least what we think they were,
right.
that it ties directly into what this guy Richter said later on to the American media in the mid-50s said right. that he had been working on, goes right back to what we think that he was working on in Germany.
Right.
And that is this some sort of propulsion, some sort of weaponized system, both, that would have explained the eyewitness testimony that there was some blue hovering craft that appeared to come up just above the tree line.
Right.
They're in this secret Nazi rocket or fuel experimental compound.
Right.
Okay. So I just want to make the point is what we know then, according to the testimony, is that the research was incomplete.
Yes.
The last time there was an eyewitness to it, it was incomplete. They could only get it to go to a certain point. This was not a free flying craft
right.
that was buzzing all around
right.
you know, Germany. It was just going up, and then it was coming back down. It would go up, and then it would come back down again.
Right.
And that was as good as they could get it to work.
That's the state of the story of Bell research right now. But there is one interesting spin to this that I want to mention that, again, connects it to Roswell. And that is, if you look at Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, in one of the passages in which he is attempting to describe what he thought was the physics of this device, it, number one, dealt with plasmas, and number two, it dealt with magnetic fields in rotation that were separated. Now, this is before any Bell Project information had been released in the English language at that time in history when Corso wrote his book. The only version of Bell research that you could read was written in Polish and by my friend Igor Witkowski. So this is interesting to me because if you look at Dr. Kurt Davis, his specialty, one of the things that he was directly involved with in the Bell Project was something that he called magnetic fields separation. And this is what Corso hints at and alludes to very specifically. So in other words, it's almost appearing to me, Ian, that Corso, when he wrote his book, was kind of getting ahead of the curve in a certain sense. And I realize that most Roswell researchers don't place much stock in his book for a variety of reasons. But on this particular point, he's out ahead of the curve. He, in my opinion, is letting people know something before it hits the English language when Igor publishes his book in English.
In what year?
I believe that was 2001 or 2002 that Igor published that. Yeah.
But I think part of what I'm getting at, and you can certainly vet this, and we're talking about the Roswell-Reich connection. You can link up to Joseph P. Farrell at our webpage at coasttocoastam.com, that it would be a motivating factor for somebody like a Juan Perón, or for that matter, for the researchers to want to continue. If they had successfully finished their research in this plasma propulsion system, in this or succeeded in weaponizing this system, if they had done that, there wouldn't be a need necessarily to continue the experiments down in Argentina. It wasn't quite finished yet. And so for scientists, he would have been able to have bartered that. Had it already been finished, he would have been able to send that up to the highest bidder on the international stage and say, I can do this. And as of yet, he hadn't been able to prove that he could do anything other than maybe go up, you know, 30 feet and come back down again.
Right. This is the big problem with the Bell story. We can take it only so far. When the project disappears from Argentina, that's 1951. But the interesting thing, again, to me about Corso in this respect is that he hints repeatedly throughout his book that there is some apparent Nazi look to the technology that they have recovered. Now, if what Corso wrote is true, then we have to look at the paperclip scientists in this country, and if the military suspected, as we've already established it did with that legitimate Air Force document that all the Roswell researchers cite, that very clearly refers to a Third Reich connection. So it appears again that Corso is actually on this point telling the truth, all right? So we've got these paperclip scientists over in this country, and we suspect that perhaps it is Nazi in origin. The man they're most likely to bring in and look at this technology is none other than Dr. Kurt Davis. And again, that to me is very interesting, Ian, that they reopen his security case file after the Roswell incident occurs.
Yeah. All right. So we'll start making some of these connections then.
Sure.
The Roswell crash occurs, as we talked about last half hour.
Right.
There is something that is recovered. It has some markings on it that appear to be Japanese or Chinese.
Right.
And then some Western numbers on these on this debris.
Right.
Can we assume from that there may also have been some Japanese that were working, since they were part of the axis of evil of World War II, that some Japanese weapons experts might have ended up in Juan Perón's protective care?
Oh, excellent question. Thus far, I have not established any Japanese scientists in Argentina. However, the really interesting thing to me, Ian, is that I am not the first researcher into Roswell that broke a potential Nazi connection. The first one to do that was, in fact, Nick Redfern in a wonderful book called Body Snatchers in the Desert, I believe. And what Mr. Redfern did is he basically recounted the stories that were told to him by a bunch of whistleblowers, that what crashed there was an American project that was being run by German and Japanese scientists launching these Horton flying wing type aerodynes on large high altitude balloons and putting progeria victims, Japanese progeria victims, into these things and testing them for various radioactive shielding things and so on and so forth.
Explain progeria for people
who don't. Well, progeria is a syndrome that occurs in children that makes them age very quickly. They don't live much beyond 16 or 17 years old. But the interesting thing that Redfern points out in his research is that progeria fits almost exactly the types of descriptions that the majority of the people that say they saw bodies describe. Okay.
Now, why would that be telling? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but to use progeria, the victims of this disease that are small, much smaller than they would have been, who are older brain function but very small bodies.
Right.
Why would that be helpful for research like this?
Well, in in the most obvious case, and Redfern points this out in his book, the most obvious case is that this involves the American military or implicates them in some rather brutal experimentation on human victims, similar type of experimentation that we're condemning the Nazis and the Japanese for carrying out themselves. Okay, that's the first obvious reason. But my problem, and again, I'm not trying to take anything away from Mr. Redfern's research at all, but my problem with it being a crash of some super secret American black project is that it does not rationalize, number one, the debris, and number two, it does not rationalize this U.S. Air Force intelligence document that I've been referring to throughout the night that indicates that the Air Force is wondering where this is coming from and pointing the finger ultimately to the Third Reich. If it had been an American black project that crashed, then the purpose of this memo is completely overturned. But this is a legitimate memo, and that means that what crashed there is not an American black project. What crashed there is something that is representative of an independent post-war Nazi state. And that would, in my opinion, force the Air Force to hit the panic button and concoct two different versions of a story. Number one, the flying saucer story, and number two, the weather balloon story. And that, to me, is the most telling feature, I think, in my opinion, against the hypothesis that Mr. Redfern advances. But let's make no mistake about it. Redfern was the one that had the courage to get out there first with this idea that it had to do with something Nazi in its technology. And he was also the one that, I think, very courageously stepped up and questioned the whole idea that the bodies, if there were any that were recovered, were extraterrestrial.
Yeah, you know, I guess I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of somebody who would be suffering a terminal disease like progeria.
Right.
And let's say you're a bright 13 or 14 year old, and you know, I mean, you just there will be no way you'll live past a certain point because your body is aging so fast.
Right.
And if somebody comes to you and says, "Would you like to spend the next 2 years doing something really amazing with your life and being involved in a scientific project?" I could see volunteering for that.
Oh, yes, yeah.
I could see if I were 13, 14, they said, "Look, we need you to fly a craft. It has to be it has to be run by people who are very small and very light, but who can't be children,
right?
Because you need to have an older intellect to be able to figure out how to run this thing."
Right, right.
Well, I mean, it's not out of the realm of possibility.
Yeah, well, yeah, I can see that happening very, very easily. Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, we'll pick it up here. Are you following us here in the Roswell Reich connection? It's the new book, Roswell and the Reich, from Joseph P. Farrell, that the crash at Roswell came from Nazi technologies that were continuing in Argentina. And we'll pick up this conversation about further proof of that next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So as we've been building the case for Joseph P. Farrell, or along with Joseph P. Farrell, on the what happened at Roswell, you say at the very beginning of Roswell and the Reich that you know that this theory is not going to make anybody particularly happy.
That's right.
You acknowledge up front that you have your discomforts with the extraterrestrial theory, but just because it may not have been extraterrestrial, it doesn't mean that it isn't mysterious. And this theory that you have about the crash at Roswell being a craft that comes out of post-World War II Nazi technologies, that this answers a lot of the questions, the outstanding questions.
Yes.
About Roswell. What do you think it satisfies most for the curious?
Well, to put it in a nutshell, I think it satisfies, first of all, why the Air Force initially, in that very first day that the story was reported, put out two such diametrically opposed versions of what had happened. because that dialectic, that dialectic between an extraterrestrial extraordinary thing and a purely terrestrial, very trivial, mundane thing, has more or less persisted, Ian, in most of the Roswell research since then. It's the people that fall into the cracks, like Nick Redfern or myself, that are saying, no, it's both extraordinary and terrestrial, and there has to be, therefore, a reason or rationalization as to why the American military panicked over this incident, as I think they clearly did. And my explanation is, well, if it's 2 years after the end of World War II and something Nazi crashes in the New Mexico desert, and it clearly is not representative of an American black project, then yes, that's going to get the American military to panic, because it means that somebody out there, a supposedly defeated enemy, has possession of a technology that can enter American airspace over our most sensitive defensive installations with impunity. And I want to add to that something I thought of during the break. In the intelligence collection memorandum that is cited by the Roswell researchers themselves, but again, I stress, cited in a faked version that is deliberately spun to point to extraterrestrials. In the original version, as I've pointed out, it points the finger ultimately to Nazi Germany. But there's something else, and this is where the details get very interesting. Because in that intelligence collection memo, the general drawing it up, his name is Brigadier General Shulgin. In his collection memorandum, he is pointing out that he wants his intelligence agents to gather intelligence on any sort of jet-propelled saucer that is able to suction the boundary layer. And the boundary layer is simply that little tiny thin molecule or two thick layer of air that is on the wing of an airplane, okay?
Right.
And the key to suctioning the boundary layer, that's kind of the holy grail of aerodynamics, because what that would do is it would tremendously reduce drag. It would be making an airplane kind of like a wet bar of soap to try and grab onto. It just slips out of your hands. It would slip through the atmosphere just like that. And this to me, Ian, is very, very telling, because one of the areas that the Nazis were working at precisely at Peenemünde was a separate project completely apart from von Braun in building these types of aircraft that would suction the boundary layer and that would be more or less like a flying saucer. One of these scientists, and I put his patent into Roswell in the Reich, is a fellow by the name of Rudolf Fleissner, who took out a patent in 1955, right about the same time the Air Force is interviewing Dr. Richter down in Argentina.
Weird.
Yeah, which is weird. Again, you know, we have all of these little synchronicities here,
right,
you know, that are pointing the finger toward the Nazis. But Fleissner takes this patent out in the middle of the 1950s, and the patent takes 5 years to be actually granted. But Fleissner came out when he took out this patent and said that this is based on the type of research that they were doing in Nazi Germany. In other words, suctioning the boundary layer, a jet-propelled type of flying saucer, and so on and so forth. So again, the document itself points to Nazi Germany. So we have all of these things pointing the finger to Nazi Germany. That, I think, is why the military panicked, because they realized they were dealing with an enemy that wasn't dead, and they had their hands on some pretty sophisticated technology.
Yet, all right, I'll play devil's advocate here.
Mm-hmm.
If this this plasma, what did you call it, magnetic separation field,
right, mm-hmm,
technology was developed successfully in Argentina post-World War II, prior to the crash at Roswell, if theoretically they could have flown a craft all the way from Argentina all the way to, you know, some point over the United States,
right,
why are we not seeing any more evidence of that today? What, or where do you see evidence that this technology has become, you know, what's now 50-year-old technology?
There's lots of it, I think. That's an excellent question. And again, this kind of makes the story very relevant. There's lots of evidence, in my opinion, but some of the most stunning to me, Ian, are some of the NASA space shuttle footage, Space Shuttle Footage 48, I think, is the number, where you have very clear evidence that there is a technology in play out there in outer space. Some of the space shuttle footage is truly amazing. And again, you know, if the Nazis were successful, and again, I want to stress, I'm not saying that they were successful in developing this plasma field propulsion technology, but it's mighty peculiar that we have, you know, Richter saying these things about what he's doing down in Argentina, and then a little later on, Colonel Corso comes along and says, oh, yeah, well, this is all plasma and, you know, magnetic field separation and so on and so forth.
Right.
But it could have been something very different that crashed in Roswell. And again, the intelligence collection document itself, where you have General Shulgin specifically requesting information about sectioning the boundary layer, jet-propelled flying saucers, and oh, by the way, try and find out where Reimar Horton is. You know?
Right, this missing guy, right.
Yeah, the missing scientist. But I think there's all sorts of evidence that we have some sort of black technology in play or in use, and much of that evidence comes from our space program itself, and again, some of this space shuttle footage. So, yeah, I think there is a high likelihood that somebody, if not the Nazis, at least somebody has developed this type of field propulsion technology terrestrially.
But that we may not, well, that we may or may not have it. If we had it,
right,
wouldn't we be in a much better position? Why wouldn't we be using it in the sense that, and I, that we would be using it to be independently, you know, free from all of the, you know, foreign oil, or why would we not be using it to patrol the skies everywhere with our own aircraft?
Well, this is a wonderful, wonderful question, and I, in fact, I love this question because let's go back to what I said about what the Nazis were up to, what they were trying to get with this gateway technology called the Bell. The first thing they were after was free energy. The second thing they were after was a field propulsion that was a practical type of field propulsion. And the third thing they were after was a doomsday weapon, because this is truly potentially planet-busting stuff, Ian. So if we put ourselves into the position of, let's say, the Anglo-American elite, and we have successfully developed this technology, the problem is that certain aspects, Ian, of this technology are so easily engineerable. What that would do then for them is it would make it a proliferation nightmare. I mean, my word, we're concerned about Iran getting atomic bombs. But like I say, this stuff would make hydrogen bombs look like firecrackers. So I think the reason for the suppression, one of the reasons, Ian, is a kind of an altruistic one on the part of the elites that may control it. Because if it gets out and into the wrong hands, then yeah, we can all sort of kiss ourselves goodbye. This I think is probably the rationalization behind that. That's an excellent question.
Okay. So, and we're going to go to questions coming up for Joseph Farrell coming up next hour, and I know that there's many other people out there that are also making these connections. Take me through the scenario, though, of what do you think happened that night? Just if only in your imagination. What do you think happened the day that they launched? What were they spying? Was it that the Nazi scientists wanted to put their new technology to the ultimate test by flying it over U.S. airspace? They wanted to taunt the USAF. What do you think happened that day in Roswell?
Oh, that's another excellent question. If we speculate a bit as to what may be going on with this Nazi scenario, and going back to the Kenneth Arnold sighting and so on, where you have all of this sudden spurt of UFO activity in 1947, if this is Nazi, then the first thing I think they're doing is sending a message to their former enemy that we have a technology that you cannot touch. And number two, I think as far as New Mexico goes, very obviously what they would be doing, in my opinion, Ian, is surveilling our defensive installations, our most sensitive defensive installations. And what I think may have happened then, let's assume for a moment that this might have been some sort of plasma field propulsion thing that crashed there. Well, in the standard version of the Roswell story, Mac Brazel, the rancher that originally discovers the debris, heard an unusual explosion-like sound during a thunderstorm, and then later that day, he went out and discovered this field of debris. Well, if this craft was struck by lightning and it's got this plasma craft, that could very well have conceivably caused it to malfunction and crash. So that's the first thing I think happens. You had a bona fide accident that occurred during a thunderstorm, because obviously we, the Americans, are not going to be flying one of our own super secret Black Project aircraft in New Mexico during a thunderstorm and taking the risk. But these Nazis, on the other hand, might do so. So I think this crashes, and I do believe that at some point the debris became clear that it had a foreign origin, namely Nazi, and that when the Air Force discovered this and came to this potential conclusion, that's when the cover-up begins. That's when that Roswell dialectic is put into place to lock out the possibility of people looking too carefully and too closely at the descriptions of this debris and coming to the conclusion, yep, this stuff all came from the Third Reich. Because America cannot afford, 2 years after the end of the war, to admit that it might be facing the old enemy, that it's still out there somewhere in secret bases producing this technology.
Yeah, I see that. It's very compelling. Or that really sort of a if you will, a tin horn dictator like Juan Perón could have outsmarted them.
Yes, exactly. You know, and that's the other part of this. If they're suspecting that this comes from Latin America, and this raises another interesting point, because, again, in that intelligence collection memorandum, General Shulgin is asking his agents to notice any unusual landing gear. And he specifically states for use in ice or snow or on water. Well, in that particular area of Argentina that Richter's project was based in, where you had that big nest of Nazis down there, that would be precisely what kind of winters you would have. They would be very, very severe, you know, kind of like what we have here in South Dakota. You know?
Right.
So, again, it's kind of a subtle little way that Shulgin is asking, well, you know, exactly where is this stuff coming from? Well, we can find that out by what kind of landing gear it might have. So all of these things, again, are pointing the finger to me as far as the Air Force's intelligence analysis and collection needs are concerned, that they're already suspecting the general area that it's coming from. It has to be a wintry area or in close proximity to large bodies of water, and that certainly that area of Argentina would do.
You made a point in Roswell and the Reich to talk about the Foo Fighters.
Yes.
Of World War II, these appearances to American and British pilots,
yes,
of what seemed to be intelligently controlled or manipulated balls of light,
right,
that come up to and then away from aircraft, almost sort of teasingly.
Yes.
But you know, it's sort of tangentially related to this in a way. I mean, were you trying to make the claim that they were extraterrestrial, or that's further evidence of secret Nazi technologies?
Well, in my opinion, it's evidence of a secret Nazi technology. And the reason I spent the time with the Foo Fighters that I did is that there are two of the classic Roswell researchers make a claim in their book that, you know, they're going out of their way at certain points in their book to avoid looking too closely at the Nazi connection. And they mention Foo Fighters in this regard. And they make the statement that, and it really is a dangerous kind of statement to make. They make the statement that at no time did the activity of these Foo Fighters endanger or appear even remotely, mildly unfriendly to Allied aircraft. Well, that just is patently untrue, because there are certainly reports of very hostile action over Europe by these Foo Fighters, and they are accompanied by the Luftwaffe actually holding back its fighter attacks on American bomber formations while these Foo Fighters go in and do their thing and break up the formations, making it much easier for the Nazi fighters to go in and then attack our bombers. So that, you know, that is a hostile action, and it betokens at least some German involvement and control over some of the Foo Fighter activity that was reported, and that's why I spent the time with it.
Well, and I appreciate that, but if they were able to do mm-hmm. what, if they were able to, if some of those Foo Fighters, as they are referred to, mm-hmm. if they were able to control that, then do you think the Germans would have been further along in this plasma technology research? That's because that represents a huge
yes.
leap ahead, it would seem, than being able to get some sort of plasma-driven craft up 30 feet and then back down 30 feet.
Right. I think the key there is that we are dealing with the Foo Fighters with probably unmanned remote-controlled drone type of aircraft. The Bell itself, the problem that the Nazis had with that, Ian, was limiting its effects on organic materials. It was absolutely deadly to anything living within a certain field around the device, and that was the real problem. And incidentally, I should mention another interesting fact. Is that the man, the Nazi scientist that eventually ended up in NASA promoting and working on space medicine issues for NASA was none other than Dr. Hubertus Strughold. Well, very recently, Igor Vitkovsky has tied him to the medical aspect of the Bell project, trying to limit the effects of that device on organic materials. So I think, you know, we have to entertain the possibility, Ian, that they may have been successful with the physics of this technology, but they may have still been unsuccessful in learning how to control its deadly effects on human beings that would actually pilot the thing.
Okay. So you're hearing this case, the Roswell-Reich connections. So many people listening to Coast have been following Roswell research over the years that you know they're going to have very good questions coming up.
Yes.
Are you ready for this, Joseph?
Well, I hope so.
It'll be coming at you faster than the rising waters of the Red River Valley. You know that, don't you?
Yes.
The major meltage has been going on here in the northern Midwest, and once more the Dakotas are in the crosshairs of a lot of flooding. My thoughts and prayers are with the people in Fargo. All right, so we'll get to your questions and comments. We'll open up the lines. We'll give you all the numbers. What's wrong with this theory, or what's right with it? What do you think he's missing in making this Roswell-Reich connection? You get in on the conversation next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. So Joseph P. Farrell, the author of many books that have come up over the years on Coast to Coast, and somebody who is making, I think, a fairly bold claim, bolder than has ever been made before, on the connection between the crash at Roswell and the remnants of the Nazi Third Reich as technocrats from inside the Nazi regime continued their exploration of these alternative energies and alternative weapons in Argentina. What's wrong with this theory? You all have been studying it for years. If they gave out advanced degrees in Roswellology, you all would be PhDs. I know that. So what works for you and what doesn't in this theory for this new book, Roswell and the Reich, coming up next on Coast to Coast? This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's go ahead and grab a couple of these calls, but there's also still more to be explored, and we'll get to a couple of questions still hanging out there from Roswell and the Reich. Joseph, you ready to go?
I am ready.
Okay. Do we make the Nazi connection? We start with Mike in Salt Lake City on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Mike?
Hi, guys. Nice show tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
I've got a question. You said that the soldiers called out to these guys at the crash site in German and Japanese, Spanish, is that correct?
Well, actually, it's not me saying it. It's one of the Roswell witnesses that claims to have discovered or seen bodies. And the story that he told was that there were some people there, including a linguist that was fluent in German and Spanish, and that he actually attempted to communicate with one of the alleged creatures. But the problem with this story is that most of the Roswell researchers now discount that witness. So again, you know, you have to kind of, you have to dig into this story to find out if the witness is even accepted by the Roswell research community. But granting for the sake of argument that his testimony is true, the peculiarity is if anyone suspected that this creature was extraterrestrial, then why are you trying to communicate to it in German or Spanish? So, you know,
I got you there. I thought maybe the soldiers that were approaching this craft would have called out and let's take our mind back to that era.
Uh-huh.
It would have been out of the European and Pacific theaters, and they would have been schooled in hailing in the enemy's language. So
right.
If they were approaching a craft with some bodies outside, not knowing the origin of the craft, they may have thought to call out in the German, Japanese, Spanish, or even Navajo if you got some Navajo guys in the group.
Well, yeah, that's certainly very plausible. But there is one thing I should add to that. One of the witnesses that I referred to in the book was actually uncovered by a man who's not even a Roswell researcher at all. His name is Dr. John Lerma, and he interviewed someone on his deathbed who told him that he saw yet another one of these secondhand dead man's testimony sorts of things. But I put it in the book because what this man saw or claimed to have seen was very interesting. He claimed to have seen this debris and to have pieced it back together. And when he did so, he saw the image of the German Balkenkreuz, you know, the German cross that was on the Luftwaffe planes during World War II. So again, you know, I think you have to kind of put it into a total context here, and the context that I'm seeing is something definitively pointing its finger towards Nazi Germany.
Interesting thoughts, and we got a lot more to get to, too. If you go online, you can link up to Joseph Farrell at coasttocoastam.com and take a look at all of the books that he's got. And how many have you written, and how many of them are still in print?
Oh, boy. I think right now, Ian, I have 11 out. I have another book coming out next month called Babylon's Banksters. I'm working on a special project with Richard Hoagland. So I've got, and in addition to that, I'm writing another book just by myself right now. So I've got a few more in the pipeline.
That sounds interesting. And you're an organist, too, right?
Organist and harpsichordist, although I haven't played in many years. I'd probably play in the cracks if I tried now.
But you're a composer, I understand.
Yes, I've composed a little classical music just for kind of personal enjoyment and circulated that kind of privately to family and friends as little gifts.
Well, Joseph Farrell, I'd like to make one suggestion to you.
What's
as
that?
A composer and a writer, Richard C. Hoagland, the musical.
Well, I'll have to run that one by him first.
No, don't ask him. Don't ask RCH. Just do it. I think we would all go see it. Richard C. Hoagland, the musical. Let's go east of the Rockies where Chris is in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Go ahead, Chris.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is if he's ever considered or heard any reports that these Nazi scientists who are accustomed to experimenting on humans actually may have used children from the Fort Sumner home for children that existed in the 1950s. That would certainly explain why children's coffins were ordered from the Ballard Funeral Home after that crash.
Well, yes, that's an excellent point, and I take your point. It stands to reason that if these were progeria victims, if these were in fact children, that would rationalize that aspect of things. But the problem with that is that the whole ordering of children's coffins story comes from none other than mortician Glenn Dennis, and he's now regarded by most of the Roswell research community as an impeached witness. But the other point I would make to that is that there are, in the case of Colonia Dignidad down in Chile before it was shut down, that just horribly notorious and barbaric neo-Nazi colony there was implicated quite thoroughly in the abduction of children. And, you know, Lord only knows what unspeakable things may have been done to them. So That would be my answer to that. I don't know anything directly with the children's home that you're talking about, but it would stand to reason that if that story about child's coffins is true from that impeached witness, then yes, that would rationalize it rather well.
International Line, Gene is in Alberta on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell.
Hello, Gene here.
Hey, Gene.
I was wondering, during your research, did you notice any military orders that, you know, would disperse units, kind of maybe like that DEFCON situation, you know, if they were panicking or, you know, redeployed their intelligence assets or lights on in the White House, you know, during those few days?
Well, that's an excellent question. No, I did not notice any specific orders that would be in the form of an alert that resulted from the Roswell crash. However, to me, it is very, very telling, and again, it's not a point that I think other Roswell researchers have picked up on. It's very telling to me that after the incident, all of a sudden, American counterintelligence decides to reopen the security cases of a lot of these paperclip Nazis. And right at the top of the list, once again, is this fellow, Dr. Kurt Davis. And just to kind of fill you in on who he is, he's not only one of these Bell scientists, he also ends up as a senior administrator at NASA during the Apollo program as a flight director right at Cape Canaveral. So this is a very, very important figure in this whole story.
Go ahead.
Yeah,
Follow up. Just
wanted to sneak one more question in. There was recently some speculation that maybe Hitler didn't commit suicide, and he did go to Argentina. Did you? Borman set most of this up, eh?
Well, there's been a lot of that was fairly ancient talk. I mean, that started right after World War II. That he didn't commit suicide or he survived. I thought the most recent evidence was, and Gene, I could be wrong on this, I'll ask Joseph, wasn't it that they had proven that they had jawbone that had the DNA of the Hitler family in it that was from the collection that was being held by the Soviet Union? Does that sound right?
I believe that's true, but on the other hand, the Soviet skull that has the bullet hole in it, I believe they've discovered was actually the skull of a woman. I personally have changed my views, Gene, a lot in the last few years on the possibility of Hitler actually surviving the war. Originally, I was, you know, towing the party line that he probably committed suicide in the bunker. But the problem is that if you go to Argentina and ask the locals around this town called San Carlos de Bariloche, they are adamant that not only did Bormann live in the area after the war and was quite conspicuous, in fact, but that Hitler himself was there in that region of Argentina. So I'm increasingly willing to entertain the idea that Adolf Hitler made it out of Argentina. And I write about all of that Bormann-Hitler survival in a book of mine called Nazi International.
Douglas in San Francisco on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Joseph Farrell. Douglas?
Yes, and it's always an honor to talk with you, Dr. Farrell. I had the honor of speaking to you the last time you were interviewed by Mr. Punnett, and we brought up the analogy of the war with the Third Reich and Nazism as similar to the Hundred Years' War in Europe,
yes,
a religious war. And I did call many years ago, after Nick Redfern wrote The Body Snatchers in the Desert, the second time he was interviewed on that subject by Mr. Nouri, I called and told him I had worked with the Roswell files and how I had explained the Japanese connection and was verifying a number of the pieces that Mr. Redfern was trying to put together in a much more coherent sense.
Right.
And what I want to say is that all of Dr. Farrell's books are excellent, and Dr. Farrell's the information is right on the money, but what's going on right now, Dr. Farrell, if I may,
sure,
is that you're looking at this through the filter of the specialist, and you are so highly specialized in so much of the ultra technology of the Third Reich that you're seeing this through there, and you're seeing it quite accurately. But what happened was when I outlined the reality of Roswell, because I worked with the files in totality, I have one of the pieces of the debris, and I was interviewed by the website Above Top Secret, and I was slammed last year with 6 pages of hate mail on talking about the truth of Roswell not being extraterrestrial, talking heavily about the Japanese connection, which I am sure you would appreciate. Right. I don't know if it's still up there. They would not interview me after that. They absolutely refused to talk to me, so I gave a response to all of the brick bath and the acid bath on YouTube. So they did appropriate that. They were kind enough to appropriate that footage, those 5 minute responses. There's about a dozen of them I did on YouTube. They put that up on their website. If that's still up there, I would hope to do an interview with Mr. Punnett, and perhaps you could be on it as well, and we could discuss the totality of the coherent picture of what happened at Roswell, because what you're trying to do in your own brilliant matter is professionally put together the pieces of the puzzle. But I had the whole coherent picture. I have the debris. After I gave out that story, my co-writer and the book we were writing had Roswell in it only peripherally, was faced with so many death threats that she actually quit the job. My website designer quit because he told me he was being paid more not to put up the website. I don't think this will happen to you because you're approaching this from the angle of an investigator looking at it from the outside. But as someone who gave the whole story from the inside, what I said was so hateful to these people. They found it so disruptive.
I know you're going to take a breath in here somewhere, Douglas.
Yeah,
I know you can't. You must have some sort of scuba equipment or something that pumps oxygen into you while you're talking at the same time. Let me get you on hold so you can get a number. Is it Miranda? I believe that's doing the phones tonight. We can get a number from you, Douglas, and that way for Joseph to get in touch with you, for him to be able to talk to you directly. Don't you think, Joseph, about if he has a debris from Roswell?
That would be
very interesting for you to see it.
Sure, that would be fine. Yes, that would be fine.
How would you be able to judge Douglas's claim that he has debris from Roswell?
Well, I mean, you'd have to submit it to a lot of chemical analysis and so on, and match what he has to the known descriptions of the debris from the various witnesses that describe it.
Well, that would be easy to retrofit that. If you know the description, you simply make the artifact. But what is there any other – there are no known photographs.
Right. That's correct.
Even there, I guess you could fake that. But if so you would require what? Some sort of testing of it and then you'd be able to help him be able to – if maybe even – involve him or be willing to talk to him about a future project. Let me get to who's on the wildcard line in L.A.? The name doesn't appear up on my screen. Jason, who's on line two? Well, Frank is in L.A. for Joseph Farrell on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, hi. Well, listen, I really, I respect what Joseph Farrell, what you, Mr. Farrell, your theory, your angle, but I think that, in my opinion, you're missing the mark. And I was going to pose this as a question, but I came after this guy that just went on for the last 2 or 3 minutes, making a statement. But I think that on the one hand, the Nazi connection, I think you're accurate on that. But I really, really believe that was there's just a lot of very compelling evidence that was a craft that was of extraterrestrial origin, possibly terrestrial if they're subterranean, but they were alien bodies. And I think that where you're mistaken possibly is that the Nazis were involved with this technology. They received that technology from the aliens. The Americans knew that. The American military was aware of that. And so they thought possibly that they were Germans, that they were Nazis flying that craft, but they were actually bodies that were recovered that were, not human. That's my opinion. Okay?
Joseph, what would you say here to Frank?
Well, I hate to disagree. In my opinion, it is the extraterrestrial hypothesis that's absolutely off the mark because, again, the physiological features described by the overwhelming majority of the witnesses to the case do not compel to the conclusion that the recovered bodies, if there were any, and let's admit this fact, the bodies enter the story 30 years after the event itself. And again, if you read Roswell,
I don't think that's true.
If you read Roswell and the Reich, you'll discover I put a table in there of all the witnesses with all the descriptions of the bodies. I discount the impeached witnesses of Melvin Brown and Glenn Dennis because they are impeached by the Roswell community themselves.
How is he impeached? I never heard that.
Well, read the book, and you'll discover from the researchers that I cite that they themselves.
I don't know if I believe 30 years.
That they themselves are the ones impeaching their own witnesses that originally put out this story.
What about the incident?
Frank, let me ask.
Wait, Frank.
Let me ask you a question. What's the earliest year, Frank, that you believe people came out and said there were bodies?
I don't know the year? I don't know what the year was, but when you take into account the Dulce incident and other encounters, why is it so hard to believe that they could be alien bodies when it's quite common knowledge that there are recovered bodies?
Well,
I mean,
on
common
this point,
knowledge
on this
amongst,
point,
I don't want everybody talking at once, but Frank, let's just say nobody's disputing maybe recovered bodies. The question is alien bodies. But go ahead, Joseph, what did you want to say?
Well, my other point that I want to make, and I hear this a lot, because what I'm doing is so upsetting to the extraterrestrial religion, and that is this idea that the Nazis had some sort of ET contact. Unfortunately, there is no good, solid evidence of it.
Although you yourself said earlier that the Foo Fighters, you believe, could have been at least in part controlled by the Nazis. There were frequent, objective, truly freaked out, you know, pilots who were saying, "I can't believe what I just saw. I never want to see that again."
Right.
But you think that at least some of those were controlled by the Nazis?
Oh yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, you know, this is why you guys are so good. At least you're asking informed questions of Joseph P. Farrell. The book is Roswell and the Reich, making this Nazi connection between the crash at Roswell and the latter-day World War II crypto-technological breakthroughs of the Third Reich after it moved to Argentina, too. Coming up, more of your questions and comments on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Joseph Farrell taking your questions and comments about his theory that there is a Nazi Roswell connection. Let's go to Tina in Asheville on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Tina?
Hi. You guys are both brilliant. I have so many questions, and I would love to pick Dr. Farrell's brain because I'm in transition from an ex-nurse to an investigative journalist myself and have been researching the UFO ET phenomenon for years. And I have a friend who was claims he was an abductee from a reptilian.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard the interview last week with, what was his name, the man from Canada who was abducted, it was a similar report like Jim Sparks with horrific repeated, you know, abductions and stuff and, you know, medical experiments and that. And I was wondering, Doctor, what you think about the UFO ET thing in relation to abduction, in relation to your research, because it seems like, I mean, even though it's so compelling and I've always wanted to know, you know, about the this horrific experience that we've had in this civilization with someone like a Hitler, you know, who could do such, you know, horrible genocide, but also mind control, you know, similar, I think, to reptilians who do mind control. So, okay, I'm going around a circle, but.
Okay, well, let's the easy way to break that is get an answer. You ask
okay,
questions.
Sorry.
It's all right, Joseph.
Well, Tina, let me be very clear. I state in Roswell and the Reich that just because I'm arguing that this is to be an event solely interpreted from the standpoint of an extraordinary but terrestrial basis, I do not hold the view that Nazi technology explains all UFO events or occurrences, and I certainly do not hold the view philosophically that there are no extraterrestrials. In fact, I am quite the reverse on that. But in this one particular case, I think it has been so carefully done that the extraterrestrial hypothesis is basically the reigning view, that no one wants to look at alternative explanations and to put Roswell in a wider context. So that would be my basic answer. And the other part of it would be that I'm simply not a ufologist. I don't research abductions or anything like that. That's very far out of my bailiwick.
But you'd have to believe in extraterrestrials if you were to write Richard C. Hoagland the musical. You'd have to.
Well, I don't know.
So when you write that, I want to be the voice of the face on Mars. Okay.
Well, I just write instrumental music. I don't write any vocal music.
Come on. All right. Well, then if you need a librettist, let me know. Okay. Because.
Okay.
And then I want to be in the love duet between the face on Mars and Richard C. Hoagland. Let's go to the we have Alex in Winthrop, Massachusetts, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Alex.
Dr. Farrell, thanks for your important work. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you this
okay.
time.
From reading your work and others, I believe that the Nazis have developed vanishing weapons.
Okay.
They may be a combination of scalar and psychotronic weapons.
Okay.
It's very important for me to understand what happens in this moment when matter is vanished. How does it occur? I mean, as simply as possible, or that may not be possible. That's my question.
Okay. Well, I really don't know. I don't think anyone has a good idea about what happens. In the case of the Bell device, what happened with plants that were exposed to the field of this device, they didn't vanish. But what happened to them was that the molecular composition of the plant simply broke down completely. The plant simply decayed into kind of a goo. But as for the kind of question you're answering, you know, that would be anybody's guess.
The blue plasma description of
right.
of the POW who saw this device rise up above the trees and then drop back down again during
yes.
World War II. Do you think that could be replicated by our finest minds today?
Oh,
let's
sure.
take okay. They're just why aren't they? Why isn't some enterprising graduate student somewhere doing that?
Well, as a matter of fact, that's another excellent question. I do believe that there was an engineer, I know his name, I probably shouldn't mention it publicly, but that there was an engineer that worked for a company out in California, a defense contractor, that did build a kind of a replica of the Bell device. And I also know a physicist in New York that contacted me in the last few months that is doing basically a replica of the device and getting his engineering and his equations together and so on and so forth. So there are people doing this and trying to do it.
Jim on the first-time caller line on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Jim?
Hey, how are you guys doing tonight?
Pretty good.
Well, my question really relates to the fact of what do you think of the idea that this stuff is still taking place modern day? Living out here in the desert here in Nevada, I see a lot of weird things at night and whatnot.
Sure.
And as you know, we have a lot of hills and a lot of secret things going on out here that we might not know much of, planes doing barrel rolls, power levels, things like that.
Right.
What is the ability of the Nazis to have today in America the ability to still create this type of things and have them going on underneath the government's nose?
Well, that's another excellent question. And again, this kind of brings things right up to the present. And it's kind of in the general area of this special project that Richard and I are embarking upon. But if you look at the fact that the war has been over for 60 years and you had this technology being developed by the Third Reich in the 30s and 40s, and you extrapolate from there with enough money and with enough manpower and, you know, determination and daring do, in my opinion, quite frankly, the sky is literally the limit. And I would imagine, to kind of put your question into a historical context here, I would imagine that we can rationalize the sudden disappearance of anti-gravity discussion in the open literature in the mid-1950s as being partially a response to what the American Air Force was learning as it was discussing all of this stuff with Dr. Richter. It's really an amazing thing when you read the documents that I reproduce in the Nazi International, because they just really had no idea what to do with this guy. Hmm. But the fact that we clamped down the security on the very subject of anti-gravity in this country indicates to me that we made some sort of response, and it went deeply, deeply black.
There are some intriguing, yes, historically undeniable connections between our past governmental leaders and the Third Reich.
Yes.
And for that matter, industrial leaders.
Yes.
Who are the usual suspects in your mind?
Well, that's another excellent question. To me, Ian, it goes back, if you want to put it into the proper historical context, it goes back to the era of the Dawes and Young plans between World War I and World War II, and particularly with the creation of IG Farben with the help of Wall Street. And, of course, that company became just this gigantic, enormous cartel that really was only finally legally liquidated in the year 2003. That was how enormous this cartel was. But the connections I think you have to look at are the licensing agreements that took place between IG Farben and companies like DuPont and Standard Oil and so on and so forth. Farben just acquired an enormous amount of technology through these licensing agreements, and many of them came from this country. So another excellent question.
Well, okay, but I want to push a little bit on that.
Sure, okay.
So do we think then that the Third Reich got folded into the U.S. somewhere in the 1950s, which allowed for this clampdown, this post-Juan Perón association? Do you think that what year did the Third Reich peter out?
Oh, an excellent question. If I'm understanding you correctly, my answer would be both happened. I think the influence of the deals that we made with the Nazi paperclip people, and additionally the deals we made with Nazi military intelligence on the Eastern Front, I think that you can argue a very strong case that certain amount of the Third Reich collapsed itself into this country and simply went into hiding inside the defense industrial complex in this country. But on the other hand, I think that there is also sufficiently compelling and clear evidence to suggest that there is a kind of post-war extraterritorial Nazi state conducting all of this research activity on its own and independently from the paperclip people in this country.
Paul is west of the Rockies in Seattle on Coast to Coast.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. It's nice to talk to you. Mm-hmm. I've been a listener since Art Bell was a guest on the X-Files. Long time. This is a great topic. I'll tell you why. My grandfather was an Oberlieutenant in the Luftwaffe. He was an engineer, and he and my father and grandmother came over right after the war. I'm the first American on that side of the family. And one of the things that you were leading about into, Ian, and you, Dr. Farrell, with IG Farben, you forgot to bring up one of the most important names, which is Mr. Prescott Bush.
Oh, yes.
He almost went to prison for selling, and then he got arrested for selling armaments and some of the military stuff to the Nazis. And,
sure.
The Bush family, the Skull and Bones, and Geronimo, that's the old death head.
Yeah.
You know, if you read The Morning of the Magicians, which is an excellent book by two French authors, they really explain, like, the secret rituals of the SS and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not. I don't believe Hitler's alive today, but Nazism is well alive today,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
all over the world. And it's about time, that's all I can say. The thing is, with this topic, it's just kind of what's going to happen is that there's just a lot of individual people like yourself. You're going to write books and you're going to make discoveries, and people that read your books, they're going to understand and they're going to come to the same conclusions. Mm-hmm. But there's going to be a cold day in Hades before the United States would ever come out and say anything, because the United States, the tentacles in Great Britain and United States from Nazism and the Vatican, of course, the tentacles just run so deep.
You threw the Vatican in there. Go ahead, back up for a second.
Well, that's because of the passports and so forth afterwards.
Yeah,
it had nothing to do with the popes.
I don't know that it has anything to do with – I think it had to do with some people within the Catholic Church.
Right.
I'm not going to –
I'm not blaming the all of Rome.
Yeah, that's just not fair. Okay.
I know about the individuals that were involved.
Yeah, in any large organization like the Catholic Church, no doubt there's going to be some people who are going to be providing passports to South America like that. It was horrible that they did that, but it's not the same as saying the Vatican was affiliated, because I think a lot of the most recent research says that the Vatican really was going out of its way in many cases to be completely subversive to Nazi power. So let's give credit where credit is due. But let's go back to the Prescott Bush connection. Yeah, that we talk about that a lot on Coast to Coast. It's come up, you know, frequently. It was one of the people I had in mind when I asked you about the usual suspects. But you didn't mention that. What? Do you think there could be a connection here on why that technology disappears?
Well, I didn't mention it because it does get mentioned so often. I'm certainly aware of it, and I do even mention that connection in the Nazi International.
Right.
But as to whether or not Prescott Bush or the Bush family may have something to do with the disappearance of this technology, I go back to what I said earlier, and that is, if you are the elite within North America and Great Britain after the war, and you're confronted with the technology, with this awesome weaponization potential, then yes, you're going to suppress it simply for the reason that you can't afford the proliferation nightmare that it would lead to. That I think is the thinking behind the elite suppressing it.
Somewhere in Flatwoods, Kentucky, there is Debbie on a phone for Joseph Farrell. Debbie?
Hello, Ian. I love you guys at Coast. I've been listening, you know, since, I guess, towards the beginning, back in the early 90s.
Glad to have you.
Mr. Farrell, I don't want to argue with you or anything like those other people, but some of the things you talked about really got my mind screaming. I had this weird uncle named, like, Rex Richter, and he had this huge laboratory at my grandfather's mansion in the basement. He had bodies like in big aquariums and stuff. He was very strange and stuck to himself a lot. He used to make me a lot of balsa wood airplanes and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And I've always thought the Roswell thing was aliens, but listening to you tonight, you know, that just really blows my mind that it totally makes sense that it would be Nazis.
Whose bodies were in tanks in your... let's back up a little bit there.
I used to have photo albums, you know, the alien autopsy picture that's real famous?
Yeah.
I had photo albums that were my Uncle Rex's that had, like, all kinds of bodies like that. They didn't have genitals. And they were real strange looking. And when he started talking about the children with progeria, I thought, you know, those might not have been what I thought all my life were alien bodies. And this photo album had the most bizarre, frightening photos you ever saw. And I haven't seen the album since I was a little kid. But I was wondering, is there any way that I could see, like, a picture of this Mr. Richter and some of these other gentlemen that you named that were possible Nazis?
Yes, I do have pictures of Dr. Richter in the book called The Nazi International. I have a picture of Dr. Davis in the book that's called The SS Brotherhood of the Bell. And Dr. Strugholz, I believe I have a picture of him as well in the Nazi International. So, yes, I do have. And you can actually go online and Google the names of these people, and you should be able to find their pictures somewhere online, Tina.
In Google Images.
In Google Images, right.
Right. I'm a little worried about Debbie's uncle. I want to look up stories about missing hitchhikers is what I'm interested in. Yikes. So here we go. We're kind of a crossroads. We got about 8 more people that want to talk to you. Want to hang on for a little extra time? Joseph?
Sure, that's fine by me. Yeah.
Are you good? Okay.
Yeah, I'm good. Yeah, I'm good.
I think in our original contract we were talking 3 hours, but there's a high demand. So if people are willing to hang on for you, We'll get them coming up next. Joseph Farrell hanging on for a little OT on the Nazi Roswell connection. Roswell and the Reich on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. What actually happened at Roswell, one of the most enduring questions, right up there with, do we really need two Dakotas? Can't we just give a goodbye without a North and South Dakota? Just one Dakota. Wouldn't that do it? Let's go ahead and get to Nancy, who's in Ontario, Canada, hanging on the longest for Joseph Carroll on Coast to Coast. Joseph Farrell. Go ahead, Nancy.
Hi, good evening. So glad to talk to both of you. I have a question. Why Argentina? Why were the Nazis interested in Argentina? And what did it have that, say, another country didn't have? Another part of the United States or or another island even? Like, what is the draw to Argentina?
A friendly attitude.
Yes, exactly.
Well, no, a lot of countries have friendly attitudes.
No.
Something else.
A pro-Nazi attitude. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, Ian's point is humorous, but it's very well taken. That's precisely why. That's one of the reasons why. But the other reason, Nancy, is that Argentina had, during the war and even prior to it, had a great deal of German business penetration into that country, so that it was very easy for the Nazis to move their technology and their patents and their funds and everything else to that country. The other reason that I think should be stressed and pointed out is that at that time, Argentina had a relatively decent infrastructure that would have allowed the Nazis to have pursued some of these advanced projects. So there's a lot of reasons, but certainly at the top of the list, as Ian humorously pointed out, you had the political climate there with Perón's government that would allow and accept a lot of these Nazis into the country.
And also the climate. I mean, there's a lot of similarities between the Alpine, you know, German landscape and Argentina, plus the farming and the other things. I mean, they and to this day, there are those communities that look like they're taken right out of Bavaria.
Oh, yes. I have some pictures in the Nazi International of some of the houses in this region of Argentina where you had all these Nazis settle. And you're exactly right. These houses are definitely German in architecture.
And that was going on even before the war. The seeds were planted, the roots had been growing before.
Yes.
And the escape plan was there all along, that if the Third Reich ever collapsed, we're all going to Argentina.
Yes, absolutely.
That was the pipeline. Let me get to JT. And in Argentina, by the way, Juan Perón and others, they wanted the Nazi money.
Yes.
They wanted the European investment. They wanted people to come and bring their, you know, Deutschmarks to, or Reichmarks, I guess, to Argentina.
Yes.
JT is in Connecticut on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell on a wild card line. JT, go ahead.
Yes. Hey, guys. Amazing show. I just want to thank Ian for a good job, as always, and Joseph, thank you for your great enduring work.
Well, thank you. I have a quick question
for you guys. Do you think there is a connection between the secret high-tech Nazi group and what could be behind what people like to call today the New World Order?
Do I think there's a connection?
Yeah, between the New World Order and this secret high-tech Nazi group in Argentina?
Yes, absolutely I do, and I'll let a little bit of the cat out of the bag with the other book that's coming out next month called Babylon's Banksters, because one of the things I look at the very beginning of that book is the one of the hidden purposes, I believe, behind the founding of the Bilderberg Group. Because what you have with that group, at least at that time, is on the one hand you have, of course, the representatives of the Anglo-American elite with the Rothschild and the Rockefeller families involved with the founding of it. But on the European side, who do you have? You have Prince Bernhard, and who's he? Well, he's a former SS officer, and that means that he is in the chain of command of this post-war Nazi international or extraterritorial state. And one of the very first and regular guests at those Bilderberg meetings was the chairman and CEO of Deutsche Bank, a fellow by the name of Dr. Hermann Josef Ops. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, what this means to me is that you had a clandestine deal worked out to move all the liquid cash from the Nazis into these Western banks, which they in turn could keep off the books and expand their ledger credit making entry ability. Now, the reason that I can say that with some confidence is that Martin Bormann, according to Argentine intelligence documents, Martin Bormann cashed a check drawn on Chase Manhattan and Manufacturers Hanover's banks in New York City for several million dollars, and it cleared through Deutsche Bank in Buenos Aires, and the check was written over his own signature. So in other words, you had kind of a post-war detente that was struck between the Nazi elite and the Anglo-American elite, and the Bilderberg meetings were, in my opinion, for the purpose of trying to figure out how to move this money and for what purpose it would be used in the rebuilding of Europe and so on and so forth.
That's heavy stuff, Joseph, and I look forward to reading your next novel.
Next historical
piece.
It is.
Take care.
Thank you. Simone in the hometown of Ronald Reagan in Dixon, Illinois. Simone?
Thank you. My question for Joseph Farrell is about the connection, the automatic connection in society of the word UFO to alien. For years, I myself have automatically connected the word UFO to alien spaceships from other planets without thinking about it.
Right.
A previous lady caller kept saying UFO, ET, UFO, ET.
Right.
And I am currently saying to myself, there is no connection when you use your brain and think about it. There's no connection in reality. They're apples and oranges. There's no evidence that UFO means alien spaceship from other planet. UFOs are real. I've seen UFOs. They're anomalous ones. They're real. I have no doubt about that. But why are they alien spaceships from other planets? And so I was questioning and thinking about that. And what do you think of my idea that the intelligence community for decades has manufactured this connection and inculcated it into society's psyche, including the abduction phenomenon as well as a manufactured hysteria inculcated into people's psyche for the purpose.
Okay, there's a lot here already. Let's go ahead and unpack some of this. Go ahead, Joseph.
Well, Simone, as I mentioned, I do not study the abduction phenomenon, so I can't answer to that part of your question. But on the other part, there's no doubt in my mind that you are correct. In fact, there have been researchers, very, very good researchers, Richard Dolan being right up there on the top of that list, that have indicated that there is an intelligence role in inculcating this extraterrestrial idea. Certainly there is. And in Roswell and the Reich, I even kind of suggest that there is a certain degree of manipulation that is present throughout the entirety of the evolution of the Roswell story that, to my mind, certainly speaks of an intelligence connection in manipulating the way the story is interpreted.
Okay, but I think it's fair to note that when we say UFOs, nobody, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's extraterrestrial. I saw a UFO. I have no idea what was driving it. I just know that it was never explained.
Right.
And in that regard, it's unidentified. But, there are others who make this connection. And so the fact that some people use them synonymously, you can't make it, complete connection, you also can't completely disconnect it either.
No, certainly not.
Right.
And most of the serious ufologists will admit to this. They themselves do not. People like Stanton Friedman or Kevin Randall and so on and so forth, they certainly would not claim that all UFOs are extraterrestrial craft by any means. Most of that association is, as she said, is at the popular level rather than at the level that serious ufology and research is conducted.
Lynn is in Ontario on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Lynn?
Hi. Oh, Ian, thank you so much for keeping this gentleman on.
everything is so fascinating. I'm just amazed and pleased you're bringing the truth out. I've got to have so many questions, and listening to you, this crossed my mind. I was going to ask about Hitler, but I was really wondering about, you know, the Operation Paperclip that happened in, you know, the States.
Yes.
Did it do a lot of damage to Canada, United States, and say the esoteric way, like they were masters of the mind? Did they do a lot of, say, secret that, you know, take over their thought processes without them knowing it, and kind of made them like they were the masters, and they were just puppets, you know, with their talents?
Well, Lynn, that's an excellent question, and to my mind, there is a clear spiritually corrupting influence that resulted from this bargain with the Nazi devil that this country and Canada included made at the end of the war. There's no doubt in my mind of this, because you have such a degree of Nazi penetration and influence in everything from the CIA after the war to the founding of NASA and in a whole lot of other ways. I think it was a very corrosive influence that we introduced into this country.
Absolutely. What do you think was the fruit of that association that you see being evidence of that kind of corrosion? Where do you see it most?
Well, I see it. That's another excellent question, Ian. I see it primarily in the... Well, in a lot of things, we have an increasingly kind of a police state snitch culture. You know, we've become a national security state rather than a republic. And, you know, our civil liberties are hanging by a bare thread. You have the whole establishment after the war of this massive intelligence apparatus, which, again, you know, Central Intelligence Agency, well, the German word for that was Reichssicherheitshauptamt, and, you know, that was the infamous and notorious umbrella agency, and it literally means either kind of a Central Intelligence Agency or National Security Agency. So even the names that we chose kind of betoken this kind of Nazi security-obsessed state. So I think you have to look almost everywhere to find this corrosive influence.
You know, that's interesting. I would argue, just to be clear, I think there's actually a long history of that predates even World War II.
Okay,
I think, whereas you may be right on that, I think that's fairly cyclical in our culture.
And yeah, I would agree with that, too. Yeah.
Our reaction to fear is control.
Yes, yes.
And I think it's a fool's game to think that we can control everything and therefore be less fearful. But you see what happened to the Japanese. Good American citizens hadn't done anything wrong.
Yeah.
And if there ever was evidence of this kind of police state, it certainly was during World War II when people weren't doing anything, were forced into labor camps.
Sure.
And
sure.
Or, you know. Or let me get to a couple other people who've been hanging on the longest for Joseph Farrell. Julie is in Nazareth, PA, on Coast to Coast.
Oh, hey, good morning. Yeah, I've been on a while, so thanks for taking my call. Please stay on this subject, Mr. Farrell. Thank you so much for keeping it in the forefront in people's minds. I don't know if you're aware of this, but I can tell you where to find a picture of J. Edgar Hoover with Hitler. It looks like in the 1950s. The caption is J. Edgar Hoover hugging his FBI lover, Clyde Tolson.
Uh-huh.
But it's clearly Hitler. It's, you know, his eyes, his jaw, his mouth. He just looks a little pudgier. It looks like about 90 years after the war.
You saying Clyde Tolson was Hitler?
Yeah, that's what it says.
Yeah, this picture. I it's in Paranoia magazine in the fall 2009 issue on page 28. And it is him. I mean, I'm an artist. I can, you know, tell, you know, certain things. I'm a portrait artist. The nose looks a little syphilitic. It looks maybe disease swollen. But other than that, this is Hitler. And they got their arms around each other, staring right into the camera.
All right. Well, I have to take your word for it until I see that picture. But I'm pretty sure Clyde Tolson was a separate person.
Yeah.
But I think he existed.
I don't know. This looks like Hitler. I don't know who Clyde is supposed to be, but this looks like Hitler.
Okay.
I wanted to, God, your next book sounds fantastic. I'm sure you've read through
the books that the Nazis themselves wrote, like Albert Speer wrote all about this in his book Infiltration.
Yes,
how
yes.
they basically created the concept of the military-industrial complex
yes.
in order to, you know, supersede, you know, be above governments and as a, you know, vehicle for them to take over the world, you know, which we're seeing with the New World Order crap. So it sounds like your next book is full of stuff like that. You know, follow the money and you find the villains.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate that. Let me get to a couple of people have been hanging on for a while for Joseph Farrell. Robert is in Culver City, California, on Coast to Coast. Robert?
Yeah, Doctor. My name is Bobby. I was interested in this case, Roswell. I actually saw a craft once over the Verdugo Hills here, and it was pretty advanced looking, and it looked something I don't believe that the Nazis would ever come close to developing. I mean, I literally don't believe that it had an anti-gravity. It stopped in midair. But I've got a couple of questions because I read Corso's book. Number one, Roswell, I believe, happened on July 3rd. Of 1947, and if there was an insignia, like you said, and some of the guys talked to them in Spanish,
right.
German, and Japanese, 2 years after the war, it would be extremely frightening. Even if they thought they were ETs, they would question possibly if they saw insignias in Japanese. I mean, I can see that as a logical conclusion to question them. Also, the Horton Flying Wing in Corso's book, Corso stated that the Horton Flying Wing might have been developed in a similar crash in Germany, similar to Roswell, that they may have recovered a craft
right.
and had developed it, and that might be the Nazi connection. But they lost the war. I can't see. Our scientists here seem to have done a great job, and our military people. So I really can't see the Germans being that far ahead of us at that time. I literally can't see it.
Joseph?
Well, I have to respond, first of all, to the allegation that the Nazis got their own version of Roswell and recovered something and back-engineered it. These stories have been circulated, but unfortunately the people circulating them ultimately boil down to neo-Nazis, so you have to question that whole approach. The other problem with those stories is that they're simply not documentable. But the plain bottom line fact is that the Nazis were working on all of these advanced technologies, and the problem is they were so advanced for their day that, yes, they did end up losing the war, but those technologies continued to be researched by them after the war. There's just no two ways about it, and I urge you, if you really want to know the argument thoroughly, get a hold of the book or get a hold of all the Nazi books that I've written and dig into the details, because the details are there.
You know, it's interesting about that, as you say, that the origin for the Nazi Roswell crash came from neo-Nazis.
Yes.
So they were perhaps trying to, again, create a myth of superiority
yes.
or of
yes.
of connection.
Yes, with. Exactly.
Yeah, I would be suspicious of just about anything neo-Nazis say. Last half hour, and thank you, Joseph Farrell. Always enjoy talking with you. I know that a lot of people are out there are just still making this connection in their mind between Roswell and the Reich. You can find out more by clicking on to our webpage at coasttocoastam.com. All I can promise is that everybody who's up on the screen right now will get into the conversation with Joseph Farrell. We'll start with Tom in Bradenton, Florida, on Coast to Coast, the first-time caller line. Tom?
Good morning, Ian, Dr. Farrell. My wife and I have a UFO paranormal group here in Bradenton, and we meet a couple times during the month, and we've gotten into a lot of conversations about why the cover-ups and everything, especially Roswell. And everything you say seems to me to be very plausible. It makes a lot of sense. So, anyway, the question that I have is, how does the memory metal that was supposedly recovered from that crash and sent to Wright-Patterson and then on to Battelle Memorial Institute tie in with this? What were the Nazis doing with that?
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad you brought that up, Tom. I really am. The standard explanation is that the memory metal characteristics, the only memory metal that was known to exist was a substance called nitinol that was invented in 1965. However, in my research, I uncovered the fact that memory metal characteristics were actually discovered by a Swedish physicist in the year 1932, and I put all that information in the book. So, you know, it doesn't take much imagination to see that this would be something of tremendous interest to the Nazis and that they probably invested a lot of money in developing that sort of stuff. So, yeah, that memory metal did exist. It was known from 1932, and you don't have to go any further than that to see that this is a terrestrial technology.
Mm. I just wondered why they would cover that up. Librarians that write Pat and the librarians are the people that kept track of all the reports that Patel supposedly lost them or they disappeared or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My guess is that when you're dealing with this particular case and dealing with missing documents or faked documents or altered documents, my guess is that this is because they don't want people looking at the Nazi connection because then it opens up too many other questions.
It certainly would do that. You know, and there are plenty of Nazi connections that exist that are known that our government still would rather have us not talk about.
Exactly.
We don't have to even go to Roswell to find secrets. Around. We know how much, for example, they knew and had been trying, you know, desperately to try to rehabilitate Wernher von Braun.
Oh, yes, yes.
When he was very committed Nazi. Nothing, he wasn't this victim that they presented him as being, this sort of Rapunzel forced to spin gold for Adolf Hitler.
Exactly, exactly. I couldn't agree with you more.
He knew all about the slave labor that was going in.
Absolutely.
Fully approved of it, asked for more of it.
Yep.
And yet, if you read the official government accounts at the time, it was just pure propaganda.
Oh, yes, yes.
Just to make the space program and rocketry more likable.
Well, I'll go you one further, Ian. In the paperclip files of Dr. Davis, and he's fairly typical.
Dr. Kurt Davis?
Yes, he's described in his security vetting files as a 100% ardent Nazi, okay, and in the very next sentence, but no security risk to the United States. So, you know, how do you rationalize that?
Yeah, exactly. 100% Al-Qaeda would make a great congressman.
Yes, exactly.
Wayne is in Halifax, Pennsylvania, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Wayne?
I'm honored you taking my call. My question is to Joseph. Mm-hmm. Is there any chance that Einstein had any hands in this about the impulsion of the spaceships?
Is there any chance? Well, yes, there's more than just a chance, because I have a book that's part of this Nazi series called Secrets of the Unified Field, in which I discuss that his unified field theory papers from, say, 1925 to 1931 definitely form kind of an ideological basis for a lot of this technology that was developed. Now, many people would point to the fact that the Nazis were against so-called Jewish physics, but the fact of the matter is that the very scientist in charge of the Bell Project, a fellow, a very famous physicist by the name of Dr. Walter Gerlach, was a defender of Einstein, and yet he was allowed to be involved as the head of this project. So Einstein is definitely a connection.
You know, the Nazis were against Jewish physics just like they were against Jewish money.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, they were just trying to find a way to appropriate it, to launder it so that they could make it their own.
Exactly.
And not look like they had and not consider the source. Carlos in North Hollywood, California, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Carlos?
Hey, good to talk to you again, Ian.
And
Joseph, I wanted to ask you, what would be the similarities in the mechanics of the Nazi Bell compared to the Philadelphia experiment? How were they similar or how were they different?
Oh, very good question. In both systems, you are dealing with rotating fields. In the Philadelphia experiment, as most people have rationalized it, you have three rotating fields along each axis of the ship. And they're electromagnetic fields, and incidentally, they're also pulsed fields. And in the Bell device, if you read all the books that I've written on it, beginning with SS Brotherhood of the Bell, you're dealing with precisely the same phenomenon. You're dealing not only with rotating fields, but you're dealing with pulsed fields. So the connection is very, very clear.
Well, and that's an interesting idea in and of itself, that you have, we have proof of participation in these programs, perhaps. I mean, if one is to accept all that is said about the Philadelphia experiment,
right.
Could we say then that there was already a blueprint for us on our side of the Atlantic for doing these types of experiments, but we couldn't get the pieces to fit right? And could they have known about that, which is why they went to Argentina instead of coming to the United States? That
is an interesting question to consider, and to be honest with you, I had not considered it before, but there are certain similarities between the two experiments, but in the case of the Nazis, I think you're correct. I think you're dealing with a much more fully rationalized physics and therefore a much more fully rationalized technology. And in addition to that, you're dealing with the Bell with a kind of nonlinear physics, and the German scientists involved with it, beginning with Gerlach, were specialists in that sort of thing. They were fascinated with the whole idea of torsion and so on and so forth. In the rationalizations of the Philadelphia experiment that I've seen, I don't find quite the same understanding of what rotating torsion fields do. So that may be another consideration. You may be correct there.
All of my physics is nonlinear.
I don't think I can do linear physics. And calling my physics nonlinear would be a very nice way of describing it. Let me go to Mike in Birmingham, Alabama, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. Mike?
Fascinating show tonight. Fascinating show. Quick comment and a question. First of all, I want to applaud your defense of the Vatican when you had someone call in and say the Vatican. Thank you very much. My comment on that is there's a lot of confusion because the Vatican and Roman Catholic priests are required to give sanctuary to Roman Catholics who ask for it. Austria, which a lot of people forget, has been and still is a Roman Catholic country. They're Catholic Germans. So after the war, yes, the church, if you had Austrians that were Catholic in the Wehrmacht and were wanting to get out, yes, the church was required to give them sanctuary. Anyway.
But Mike, let's also make the point. Sanctuary and helping them falsify passports are two different things.
Well, you know, the priest or the bishop, if it was a brother or a family member, I'm sure he would be much more inclined to go a little further than what was required.
I understand that, but I think it's fair to separate out to say that priest
wasn't sanctioned by the church getting the Nazis away from the trial.
It
was more a sanctuary situation and mindset is what I'm getting at.
But if they provide them sanctuary to keep them from being killed, as opposed to keep them from being prosecuted for crimes, I think that's the difference.
I think both occurred. And
you may be right, but to go the extra mile to help arrange passports, that was beyond the line of what any priest, according to church doctrine, would be required
to
do. Right.
Certainly.
All right. Go ahead.
I think that was the motivating factor more than Nazis in the church or something, because they helped very many Jews escape the concentration camp. Anyway,
it is a mixed historical record, to be sure.
Absolutely. Yep. But my question has to do. You're talking a lot about the relocation to Argentina. Mm-hmm. Now, I have always, and I don't know how factual this is, heard that there was the possibility of submarine bases in Antarctica. Now, if that's a possibility, is there a laboratory for, you always hear about these people sighting UFOs coming out of the ocean.
Right.
Perhaps Antarctica, these bases and the close proximity to Argentina, maybe there's a correlation. And I think it's also interesting to note that the international organizations have prevented official colonies in Antarctica. And the countries that seem to really push that are who? The Soviets and the French, the people that not necessarily were very friendly towards the Nazis. Is it possible that the reason these international treaties have not wanted countries to go down to Antarctica is perhaps that's the Nazi laboratory for all of these tests and possible UFOs?
Interesting.
Well, to answer your question, there is a kind of a mythology out there that the Nazi expedition in 1938 and 39 down to Antarctica actually was for the purpose of reconnaissance for possible bases, okay? And as a result of that mythology, there has always been a certain group within the UFO community that has argued that the Nazis did establish research laboratories and so on there. But in my opinion, that is highly unlikely for two different reasons. The first being that with the Bell Project, you had a device that required enormous amounts of electricity to the point that the Nazis actually built an entire electrical power plant right there at the installations where this device was being tested. So you would have had to have built something like that down there, and that would have been, for that time period, virtually impossible for anybody to do, especially under wartime conditions. And that brings up the second point, why I regard that idea of a research facility there as being very unlikely. And that is that the German Navy during World War II was so operationally outclassed by the combined sea power of the United States and Great Britain that it would have been exceedingly difficult for them to construct a base like that. I don't doubt that they had submarine bases of some sort operating in the very southern tip of Latin America and possibly Antarctica, but a research base I have some misgivings about.
You know, there were some Nazi expeditions which were just about claiming Nazi glory.
Yes.
And getting international attention for their claims of superiority. But that I could understand why anywhere Nazis show up with a flag and with a camera crew, it could be either, you know, one of these propaganda campaigns, or they could have been scouting something out simultaneously, too. And just, you know, we never know what the hidden agenda was. It just, you would think we would have known if they had done that, because that would have been, you would think that there would have been evidence of that, that photographic evidence, and nothing else, that would have surfaced from that.
Well, yeah, that's the other problem. I do think that there was a hidden agenda at work with that expedition, Ian, because the two sponsors of the expedition were Party Reichsleiter Rudolf Hess on the one part, and then on the other, Reichsmarshal Hermann Göring, who, you know, was probably not the type of person to be involved in just a purely propaganda thing. But on the other hand, yes, I think you're correct that the whole Antarctica story has probably been blown way out of proportion to what actually was the hidden agenda. We don't know, because the Nazi records of it have never, to my knowledge, either turned up or been declassified. No one seems to know where they are.
Kirby is in Lewistown, Montana, on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell. If we hustle, we can get our last two callers in. Kirby?
Okay, I'll hurry. I was going to ask Dr. Farrell if he was familiar with David Hamill's work.
No, I'm not. The name is vaguely familiar to me, but I am afraid I'm not.
He is the gentleman that built a working UFO based on magnetic vibration and levitation that took off and disappeared because he forgot to add the control mechanism that slowed the rotating of the cones down that generated the anti-gravitational force.
Are you talking about John Searle?
No, it's David Hamill.
David Hamill. No, I'm not familiar with him, no.
There's a book out called The Granite Starship. Is written by another author about David, and then there's one called The Granite Man and the Butterfly, which is a relatively rare book, but it details, has a lot of pictures. It's very interesting. He worked on it for about 25 years up in Canada and had one of them explode on him, and the other one he was working on, it was camouflaged as a water tower in his front yard, and it took off and it blanked out all the radios and all the TVs and all the cars died. And every time he tried to send the plans into the Canadian Patent Service, they raided his place and stole everything.
Yeah.
So,
no, very interesting.
Anyway,
I appreciate that. Thank you, Kirby. Yeah, I appreciate. And let me get D, if we have time, in Tucson on Coast to Coast for Joseph Farrell, and then I think that will do it to it. D.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. What I wanted to know is the connection between the Rothschilds and the Nazi hierarchy. I can't understand how
they were able to collaborate with the Nazis and not suffer any repercussions after the war? And also, does Joseph know Jim Mars?
Yes, I do know Jim. He's a personal friend of mine. As for the Nazi Rothschild collaboration, there certainly was a degree of it. But, you know, I would hesitate to draw any more conclusions from it because I simply have not researched the subject well enough to be able to tell you.
But there's plenty of it out there. In fact, Jim Mars would be somebody that would, if anybody's tracked that, it would be Jim and his book. About half a dozen of his books, I would think. But I was trying to think of the secrecy book, the title of but I suddenly can't think of it. Well, there you go. And maybe there's a role when you actually get down to it, when you write Richard C. Hoagland the musical, we can put a part in there for Jim Mars.
we'll see.
I think that'd be great. You know, you're such an open guy, and it's always a pleasure to chat with you. We don't often hold guests for all 4 hours, so thank you for being worthy of that distinction.
Well, thank you, Ian. I've enjoyed it as always.
Okay, and the new book is out. You can link up to Joseph P. Farrell right there online at coasttocoastam.com. Look forward to those next books, too, that I know you'll get out soon. I look forward to continuing the conversation here on Coast to Coast. Got another big week coming up. I want you to hold in your thoughts people that are in the area not too far away from Joseph in Fargo. As the snow up here, the big snowpack in the upper Midwest is melting rapidly. Hit almost 70 degrees today. It was a surprise. It spiked up, and it's staying warm at night, which means that this runoff may create flood levels higher than has ever been measured before. So keep an eye on that. And if you've got a few extra dollars to share with the Red Cross or other charities, hold them in your thoughts, if nothing else, and be ready to jump in if needed, because I have a feeling they're going to need it. They use TAMA, and I do too.